Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Aaron Schrank.
And I'm Melody Edwards. This summer, there's been a big push by the nation's powerful teachers' unions to completely revamp the nation's standardized tests mandated under No Child Left Behind and how they fit with the new Common Core standards the state has adopted. The issues are controversial in Wyoming, too. Reporter Matt Laszlo has the story on how the state's congressional delegation is addressing the issues.
Teacher unions everywhere are mad. Educators say after 12 years of implementing standardized tests nationwide, those tests are proving impediments to teachers. And if they don't get the reforms they're demanding, they say the president should oust his Secretary of Education, Arnie Duncan. Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi serves on the Education Committee. Like most Westerners, he doesn't like East Coast educators meddling in local education policy.
Well, I don't know very many people in Harvard or Yale that understand Wyoming. Those are considered to be the fonts of education, not the mainstream schools of the United States.
Enzi's committee is looking at how to both maintain a national standard while also freeing teachers from what many say are onerous requirements. There's broad bipartisan support to reform the No Child Left Behind law, but the question is how.
States like Wyoming will concentrate on the kid. States like New York will concentrate on the test.
But Enzi and his fellow Republicans have failed to reach a compromise with Democrats, so a law that both parties don't like anymore remains on the books. Hence, the Obama administration introduced its new standard, Common Core. It attempts to set new benchmarks for schools and students. It's voluntary because Congress never passed it. Enzi says that's left the nation's educational standards in disarray.
When you have a president that with the stroke of the pen is willing to do anything that he wants to do, and it takes 3 years for the courts to catch up with him, you've got what we've got right now, which is a strange emphasis on education, national testing, Common Core, and it's a mess.
Connecticut Democratic Congressman Joe Courtney is also on the Education Committee. He says the administration is being forced to bypass Congress because lawmakers are neglecting their fundamental responsibility to either scrap or rewrite No Child Left Behind.
I mean, we know the flaws that existed in the result as a result of No Child Left Behind, and we should take up a new measure, which, again, is about 4 or 5 years overdue. Give states more flexibility, try and set up programs that measure school success differently than the one-day, one-test model, which, again, I think doesn't really move the ball forward in terms of increasing proficiency.
But Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis doesn't want federal lawmakers like herself meddling in local education issues.
The Wyoming state constitution provides that education policy is the province of the state of Wyoming. And the United States Constitution is silent on education. So here we have a 10th Amendment that says things that are not expressly assigned to the federal government through the Constitution are the province of the states and the people.
Still, Lummis sees glaring problems at home, like that not a single student in the state took the advanced placement test for computer science.
There are indications nationally that Wyoming is underperforming, but it truly is not my province as the member of Congress to address that. That really is the responsibility of the people of Wyoming.
On the ground in Wyoming, Common Core is opposed by all Republicans running for state superintendent, and the Democratic candidate has expressed some concerns. Kathy Vetter is president of the Wyoming Education Association, a statewide teachers organization. She says the new Common Core regime is a mixed bag, because it's really just a set of minimum, though high, standards.
So I don't see the Common Core as bad because it sets some high standards for all students. Where it sometimes gets messed up is as it comes down and we tie all of this testing to the different things that we're doing. So it's really the implementation of it, taking the time to make sure that all of the education employees have the professional development so they understand the standards for their content area, their grade level.
What Vetter doesn't like is No Child Left Behind. She says it depletes resources while also demanding high standards.
Well, I don't see that high-stakes tests really have helped funding because the cost of tests are enormous. We keep spending more and more developing a different test and redoing our tests every couple years instead of putting it into textbooks or professional development or supplies for students or in other states' buildings.
To Vetter, Washington lawmakers seem to just talk a good game.
It's very frustrating because you talk with them one-on-one and they all agree, yes, it needs to be reauthorized. Yes, there are things that are bad, but it doesn't seem to move. It is very frustrating because I do hear it from lawmakers across the country that say, yes, we need to get this changed, but somehow we can't seem to get moving on that change.
Lawmakers aren't expected to touch the nation's education policy ahead of November, so local educators are once again left waiting to see if Washington will throw them a lifeline or just another hurdle to try and jump. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo.
Jillian Bailo is one of three Republican candidates running for the office of State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Bailo has worked for the late Senator Craig Thomas and current Governor Matt Mead. For 10 years, she was a classroom teacher. She has worked for the State Department of Education, and currently she is with the Department of Family Services, where her duties include early childhood education. She speaks with Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck.
What's your position on Common Core?
I know that we need high standards for our students. We want them to be successful in school and life. As a leader, I see some pretty significant issues with Common Core in Wyoming, and I don't think that it's right for Wyoming. Here's why. Number one, when the standards were adopted in 2012, the Wyoming Content and Performance Standards, there were no changes in content or format from the Common Core standards. That means that the process that they went through didn't reflect perhaps the values and views of Wyoming citizens. There is a process that is laid out that the superintendent is responsible for facilitating, and I don't believe that all voices were heard in that process. The other concern that I have about Common Core is that every step we take into Common Core, we take a step away from local control. So lots of folks will say they're not national standards, and they, you know, to be fair, they didn't start off as national standards, but they take on a national flavor when most states have adopted them and when there's a national assessment that's aligned to them. So those are just a couple of the issues that make me think it's not for Wyoming.
Do you think it takes away time from classroom teaching because of some of the assessment and knowing that, gosh, if I want, I'm going to want my students to do well on this?
Right. Over-assessing is always an issue. When we as a state adopt new assessments, we need to take careful stock of what assessments we already have and what needs to go, kind of like cleaning out your closet.
Let me ask you specifically maybe about the next-gen science standards, because nobody's talking about that in our state. What have you made of all of this?
If we are to have Wyoming science standards, we have a number of unique science topics in Wyoming that ought to be reflected at every level in the Wyoming science standards. So I'm a Gillette girl. I'm a Campbell County grad. I never toured a mine until I was out of high school. We didn't learn about the mining industry in our energy industry in school. That was on my own time. I think we can do kids a better service by bringing in those science topics and putting them into our science standards and seeing our Wyoming students learn about our unique science topics.
Why not, though, just include that in curriculum and not in the standards?
We can. Certainly we can. But I think what you'll get is a smattering, as I talked with Ag in the Classroom folks, they said, well, we have these curricular materials because we know districts probably won't develop them on their own. And rather than taking up meaningful instructional time, we've designed them to be put in when there's a rainy day and no recess. And that's not the way to go about important science topics in Wyoming. So I would like to see those have a place in Wyoming standards, and so that we make sure that no matter where kids are from, they're getting the same instruction, same information about Wyoming science.
Are we too far down the road with Common Core to tear them up and come up with our own standards? I mean, or is that something you think you could do if you got elected?
You know, as an educator, I think that there are some decent components to the Wyoming Content and Performance Standards, which, again, are the Common Core standards. I think we have a starting point. The great thing about education is that it's all about continuous improvement. I think we take what we have, we take a look at what what folks have issues with. We take a look at what's not included and needs to be included, or what needs to be gone completely, and we work from there. I know that districts have worked very hard to align their curriculum and their teaching materials, spent a great deal of time and money to do that, and so repealing them, I think, is rather unrealistic, especially when we have a process that's articulated and in place to take care of those. We'll be adopting new standards for English language arts and math in 2017, and what I intend to do as superintendent is day one begin that work with the State Board of Education, with local school districts, local school boards, and most importantly with citizens, to make sure that we have a robust process where the centerpiece is information from citizens and from local school boards and school districts, and that centerpiece drives the recommendations to the State Board of Education.
Jillian Balo is visiting with us. She is a Republican candidate for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. One of the things that certainly has been an issue here for the last few years, and it's led to some of the discussions we just talked about, but the legislature is trying to play more of an active role in education. They are developing some accountability, have developed some accountability measures, and probably will continue tracking that very closely, worrying about the money we're spending on education. So they've had quite a robust involvement in this, and it goes back to what you were saying. We're probably seeing a lot of top-down approach coming from them versus the local folks getting involved. How do you reverse that, or how do you reach a compromise?
Great question, Bob. So as a government leader for the last 8 years, I've led in some very challenging times. I've been part of government reorgs. I've been part of the effort to make government work better for people and be more effective and efficient, and I've been successful as that. So I take that into this. And what I see that has happened over the last 4 years is a whole lot of chaos with a whole lot of people who care about education. When there's a lack of leadership and a lack of management at the state level, everyone thinks that they need to take the reins, and I think that that's what's happened. So our legislature has taken the reins, and I'm pretty sure that most of them would agree that they would rather be hands-off or more hands-off. But when we have a superintendent who lacks the ability to lead and manage in education, what happens is that we do continue to have top-down decisions being made because no one is facilitating those decisions. As superintendent, I know that one of my jobs will be to convene those groups that have been going different directions and taking the reins, and will be to really collaborate, coordinate, and consult with those folks so that we're going in the same direction in education.
Jillian Balo is Republican candidate for State Superintendent of Public Instruction, one of three folks on the ballot, hoping to get your nomination. We thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
When we come back to Open Spaces, the latest in our pipeline series, and a look at politics on the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces.
Back to Open Spaces. I'm Aaron Schrank.
And I'm Melody Edwards. If you've ever heard about a tool called a pig before, it might have been in this 1987 James Bond film.
We must hurry. Get him in the pig.
Pig? What is pig?
Scouring plug to clean out the pipeline. This one's been specially designed to carry a man.
Pipeline? You mean our pipeline?
Great Soviet achievement, piping natural gas into Western Europe.
Pigs are a real thing. And they don't just clean pipelines. They're also used to check the millions of miles of pipeline that crisscross the country and the globe for corrosion and other problems. Today, as part of our ongoing series about pipelines, Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce takes a look at these inspection pigs and what they're capable of.
It's a blustery morning at the True Company Tank Farm on aptly named Tank Farm Road, just outside of Guernsey, Wyoming. And a group of workers are standing around a tangle of exposed pipes. Engineer Sean King is teaching me pipeline vocabulary.
This is a pig trap. We call it a launcher. The other one just on the other side is a receiver. So this is how we launch inline inspection tools are what we call smart pigs.
Smart pigs are nothing like cute little Wilbur in Charlotte's Web. In appearance, they're more like the futuristic Sentinels from the movie The Matrix. Like the Sentinels, smart pigs are equipped with a host of precision sensors that are designed to pick up things like dents and corrosion in underground pipelines.
The original cleaning pigs were basically a tube that had wire wrapped around them. And when they went through the pipe, it sounded like a pig squealing.
Pigging, it turns out, is also a verb. And on this particular day, King and his team are about to pig a 12-mile section of the Belle Fouche pipeline between Guernsey and Fort Laramie in eastern Wyoming. As far as they know, there's nothing wrong with the 40-something-year-old pipeline. But King says it's due for its federally mandated 5-year checkup.
You know, we have National Historic Site, you know, with Fort Laramie, and we have the river in Fort Laramie. So you can only imagine what would happen if there was a problem.
It's for precisely that reason that the government makes True inspect the line. But very few pipelines get the pig treatment. Less than half of hazardous liquids pipelines and less than 10% of natural gas lines in the country are in areas designated as sensitive or high consequence.
That's open already, yeah. It's open already. Yep.
The crew starts opening valves to let in the oil that will carry the pig down the pipe. For a second, it seems like nothing is going to happen. Then, it's like a freight train.
There it goes.
Pigs are the first line of defense against problems with the nation's pipeline network. But it's a mistake to put too much faith in the pigs, according to Carl Weimer with the Pipeline Safety Trust and Industry Watchdog Group.
It's a pretty good technology, but it's very dependent on the company using it correctly.
And it turns out the pipeline companies have a lot of latitude in how they use them. The federal agency which regulates pipeline safety, known as the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, declined repeated interview requests for this story. But as Carl Weimer explains, the agency mostly leaves things up to the companies.
They do the inspections. They run the gadgets through the pipelines that find problems. And then the federal inspectors will go into their office and inspect that paperwork to see if they have followed their own plans for keeping things safe.
It's a little more complicated than that, but not much. And with 2.6 million miles of pipeline in the ground and a combined total of just about 500 state and federal inspectors, safety advocates like Weimer worry problems might be slipping through the cracks, especially as new pipelines are built.
We're into another big boom now that we haven't seen in years and years.
And as one pipeline executive put it at a recent industry conference, producers are counting on pipeline companies to lay the track in front of the train. If the metaphor of running away from a speeding train doesn't inspire confidence, Weimer says it shouldn't.
You know, the federal inspectors went out a few years ago when the boom started and did some on-the-ground inspections, and they were kind of aghast at what they found going into the ground.
Shoddy welding, poor pipe quality, inadequate coating, the types of problems pigs hopefully find if they're used.
1050.
Back out on the decades-old Belle Fouche pipeline, Sean King, the engineer, and I are sitting in his white pickup truck, listening to the pig's progress on a geophone plugged into the car's stereo system. As the pig races past, it's collecting millions of data points, which will take months to process and interpret. King says it will catch most things. But what about the things it doesn't catch?
I don't think there's ever been a pipeline company out there that has never dropped a drop of oil on the ground, you know? It's kind of inevitable.
And with 500,000 miles of pipeline planned for the next few decades, those spills are only likely to increase. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Over the years, it's been a challenge to drum up political engagement on the Wind River Reservation. But things may be different this year, with 8 tribal members running for office in multiple parties. It's an unusually high number. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards explains why so many Native Americans decided to run.
Democratic Representative Patrick Goggle says it's anything but politics as usual on the Wind River Reservation.
I would say that's probably the largest number of natives that I've seen file in a primary election.
And it's his theory that what has inspired so much political gusto is the shifting dynamic in the Republican Party. He says the politicizing of the right wing is happening everywhere, including Wind River.
The Tea Party movement in Wyoming has created what I would say political opportunities for those that have extreme right-wing views.
So are you saying that some of the tribal members are falling into some of those categories?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Constitutionalists, libertarians, Democrats, tribal members are campaigning under many banners and often against each other. For instance, Northern Arapaho Alan Whiteman is running on the GOP ticket for Senate District 25 for Cale Case's seat against two other Democratic tribal candidates, Sergio Maldonado and Travis Brock. And the same goes for Patrick Goggle's open seat. But for his seat, Republicans have an advantage in a red state like Wyoming when they don't have to face an incumbent.
And I realize that. But I also realize that if certain folks were to step forward on the Democratic side, it would be a political race determined by natives that voted.
So Goggles encouraged his niece, Andrea Clifford, to run. She has experience as an intern at the state legislature and as the assistant manager of the Wind River Casino. Clifford says her reasons for filing were simple.
We need a voice down there in Cheyenne at the Capitol.
But her primary won't be so simple. She's running against Eastern Shoshone Wilfred Ferris. And even if she wins her party's nomination, she'll face Northern Arapaho Daniel Cardenas on the GOP ticket. But Clifford says she thinks that a lot of choices for tribal candidates on a ballot is good for voters.
Actually, when I found out I was going to have an opponent in the Democratic primary, I was happy. I really was. I didn't want to be uncontested because I want our constituents to learn. And I think it would force them to say, hey, I got a choice here. So let me inform myself about both of the candidates.
And there could be a stronger gravitational pull to run this year because of an urgency to solve big issues on the reservation, like Medicaid expansion, water issues, not to mention the Environmental Protection Agency decision that set the reservation boundary to encompass the city of Riverton. Sergio Maldonado is running for Senate District 25, Cale Case's seat. He says when it comes to complex issues like these, it's more important than ever to have tribal members in office.
It's not about being invited to the table. It's about being on the agenda at the table. We secure 33 and 25. The whole state of Wyoming, and more importantly, Fremont County, will have much to be happy about. Because now this whole notion of diversity is going to be in the political arena. This is historical and precedent setting.
But with tribal members running from both sides of the aisle, securing a united front won't be so straightforward. The political face-offs this year aren't just intertribal, either. They're also interfamily. Democrat Kaja Whiteman is running for her third term as Fremont County Commissioner. In the general election, she'll face her sister-in-law, Valera Whiteman, and Mark Lambert, both tribal members, running for her seat on the GOP ticket. But Kaja isn't interested in discussing such divisions. She says the important thing is that people are getting involved.
I'm interested to see who will prevail from the primaries. I'm just a huge advocate for getting involved in your government, and I hope that everyone who comes out on top really campaigns hard in a positive way.
Kaja says whether people are voting for her party or not, she hopes the large number of tribal names on the ballot will mean a higher voter turnout for the primary election on August 19th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Coming up on Open Spaces, we talk with one of the candidates for Secretary of State. We'll hear how an influx of international students from China is shifting music education in the West, and look at transportation issues in Cheyenne. This is Open Spaces.
to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Aaron Schrank. Ed Murray is one of four Republican candidates for Secretary of State. Murray is a longtime Cheyenne businessman. He tells WPR's Bob Beck that his experience will bring new perspective to the office.
What types of ideas do you have that might, I guess, help business in the state?
Wyoming needs to remain a place where young people coming out, pursuing their dreams, can get from point A to point B without the outrageous challenges and hurdles that our younger generations face nowadays in small business. And that was a catalyst for my reason to jump into this race when I saw that Max Maxfield was going to retire, and when I saw the choices that were that the voters had in terms of those throwing their hat into the rings. I said to myself, you know, it's time for new blood, time for a new perspective.
Well, what I hear from young entrepreneurs, the biggest thing is obviously getting funding and that sort of thing. Banks aren't giving loans, and so acquiring the right capital is a challenge. How might you be able to work on things like that from your position, do you think?
Well, number one, I'm a strong advocate in investment in Wyoming. And so one of the major platforms of my candidacy is that I will advocate the reinvestment of Wyoming wealth into our communities for infrastructure, for workforce development, for quality of life. And then with that are the building blocks for entrepreneurism. And with entrepreneurialism comes the relationships with banks and funders who believe in the ability of that person to get the job done.
Ed Murray visiting with us today. One of the things the office has been very active in recently is looking into various types of fraud, consumer protection, that sort of thing. How do you think that's going, and where would you like to see that go?
Max Maxfield's legacy, I believe, will be in attempting to address the Shell Corporation issue in Wyoming. And in these regards, as you may know, Wyoming, being business friendly, it does invite fraud. And so the Shell entities that have formed in Wyoming, 90% of them, maybe higher percentage, are for legitimate purposes. But there is a percentage that is utilized for fraudulent or scam purposes, and I intend to fight that hard, very, very. That'll be another pillar of my platform in going into office, is to fight this fraud hard. And it's something that I'm very passionate about. From my business perspective, we need to get the crooks out of the system, and I will do that.
One of the other topics, certainly, that is huge is the whole elections piece of this. And as somebody in the media, I'm like everyone, we get a little frustrated sometimes. The results don't come in as quickly as we'd like, and sometimes there's malfunctions. I'm waiting for you to tell me you're going to solve all of that for me.
My principal responsibility as chief election officer for the state of Wyoming would be to have integrity in the system. And then we rely heavily upon the clerks of every county. And so I'm gathering information that will enable me to understand the unique circumstances that exist in every county that can best facilitate not only reporting, but one of my objectives, another pillar of my platform, is to increase voter accessibility and turnout. And there's some exciting ideas I have, including voting centers, and also the utilization of e-poll books that would enable, for example, someone in Natrona County who perhaps works in Midwest but lives in Casper, instead of having to return halfway across that county to vote, they would be able to vote wherever it's convenient to them, whatever precinct or center is most convenient to them. It's a wonderful idea, and a large percentage of the clerks with whom I've been visiting really are embracing this concept.
Maybe a last thing for you, and I've asked all the candidates this, whenever there's a change of any of the top elected officials, people who utilize state lands in the state and people who are watching state lands in the state always get very nervous and wondering what your philosophy will be when it comes to those. So I thought I'd ask you about that.
Well, first of all, I believe in public access and multiple use, absolutely. It belongs to the people, and I will ensure a careful balance both of the energy blessings that we have and those outdoor blessings for generations yet unborn.
Do you anticipate you'd be reluctant to sell state lands?
I don't like the idea of selling state lands. It belongs to the people. It's entrusted to the people. There are circumstances that may necessitate examining, and there's precedent for the state, sell of state land, but it's on a case-by-case basis. There must be net gain for the people of Wyoming.
Ed Murray, a pleasure. He's one of your Republican candidates for Secretary of State, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob, for this great opportunity.
Last April, Cheyenne's Y.ID services moved into a new building. It's bigger than the old one, with more staff and faster lines. But it's also a few miles out of town. There isn't an easy way to walk there, and unlike the old building, it's not connected to bus service. The move probably isn't a big deal for most Cheyenne residents, but as WPR's Miles Bryan reports, it's had an outsized effect on some in the city.
The new Y.ID Services building sits just off the highway, next to a McDonald's. I wanted to see what it was like to get there without a car, so I walked from the nearest bus stop, which is about 2 miles away. I kept my recorder on.
Man, it's hot. It's windy. There isn't really a sidewalk. This sucks.
Unlike me, Jason Capps actually did need to get a new ID recently. His first attempt was with his wife.
We hopped on the bus one day, and we asked him, was there any place that the bus system dropped off that was anywhere near to where we get our license? Of course not.
Capps works as a cook at the Comia House, a homeless shelter in Cheyenne. After finding out there isn't a bus service, he decided to walk to the ID building, a journey he quickly found out wasn't meant for pedestrians.
So you have to literally walk along the side of the highway where there's nowhere that you can be. You know, trucks rushing by all the time, people not paying attention. It's kind of scary.
For Laura Hutto, ID Services' new location is more than an inconvenience. She's disabled and eats most of her meals at the Comia shelter. Her daughter spends her days working at the temp agency Labor Ready, and Hutto says that with no way to get an ID, she won't be able to register for disability benefits.
I can't get help without the picture ID. And my daughter goes to Labor Ready at 5 o'clock in the morning. And then the times that she doesn't go to work for Labor Ready, we have no transportation to get where we're going.
Stories like Caps and Hutto's are not uncommon around the Comia House. Having a state ID is a standard requirement for basic services like registering for benefits or even getting a bed at the shelter. And an ID is required for almost any job. For people trying to get back on the ladder, getting that piece of plastic is often the first rung.
They have moved their driver's services office from a place a block down the road here. Our stop is actually in there at the flagpole.
Joe Doherty is the director of the Cheyenne Transit Program. When I asked him why there wasn't a bus to the new ID place, he took me for a drive to the old ID building. That building was just a couple hundred feet from the nearest bus stop.
At one time, our stop was back here where it was really fairly close and convenient for passengers.
Doherty says that ID Services didn't tell him about its move until right as he was finishing up the city's new master transit plan. And he says that even if he had known, the building's out-of-the-way location made it prohibitively expensive to give it a bus route.
Time is money in bus operation, you know. Bus operations cost $35 to $60 an hour. And when you're doing this 13 times a day, maybe with a passenger, maybe not with a passenger, it becomes costly.
It's unfortunate that the bus doesn't go out there. We're hoping eventually it will. I don't know exactly, you know, when that will be possible.
That's Dave Kingham, a spokesperson for YDOT. He says that he knows the inaccessibility of the new building is a problem, and he's working on ideas to fix it. But he also says that for people who can make it out, the new building is working really well.
Lower cost, more space, but also better service. You know, this is a better facility to serve the customers that are coming in.
Back at the Comilla House, Jason Capps says that his community can't afford to wait.
There's people there who could get jobs, who need jobs, and other people not just living at the Comilla, just other people in town who need to get out there.
But there isn't a plan to get a bus line to Cheyenne's ID services anytime soon. And as the summer gives way to winter's chill, the problem may only get worse. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Miles Bryan.
Every year, nearly 500,000 Chinese students travel abroad to attend college. The U.S. is the most popular destination for these students, many of whom come to study Western classical music. And for the last decade or so, Chinese musicians have taken center stage in that world. Reporter Rebecca Golden has the story.
At the University of Wyoming, an overwhelming majority of master's students in music performance come from China. Of the 9 graduate recitals last year, 7 were for Chinese students. Piano professor Qichen Wu, who grew up in Taiwan herself, says she often travels to Asia to recruit Chinese students.
When I am invited to give concerts, then I will tell faculty there that I'm willing to conduct master classes where students can play for me, so they get to know me as a teacher.
While young Chinese performers come to the U.S. for training, and many hope for lucrative orchestra or soloist positions, living in a foreign country far from home creates unique challenges for these young artists. One survey conducted at Indiana University found Chinese students had few American friends. Many felt isolated. Jason Goh, a graduate student in piano performance at UW, says there are unique barriers to making American friends.
I wanted to make some friends, American friends. However, it got some limitations because I'm the piano student, so most of the time I need to spend in a small practice room to practice. So, and we do have different cultures between American people and the Chinese people. So that's make a huge gap to make a friend.
Many Chinese students begin to play piano or violin at the age of 5. Detroit Symphony Orchestra bassoonist Michael Ma explains parents often make this decision for children, expecting them to become professional musicians, and usually choosing the instrument that the child will play for a lifetime.
I didn't decide it. My dad decided for me because he's a super music fan, and he always wanted me to be a musician, and he started me on violin. Finally, he got an idea, says, look, you got to pick another instrument. You don't have to play violin, but you have to pick another instrument. So that's how I start, you know, to learn the bassoon.
Ma studied bassoon in Topeka, Kansas for a semester before moving on to the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Connections between China and the U.S. moved beyond the classroom. With Ma's help, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra premiered a new work by Chinese composer Zhaogang Yi last summer. DSO President Ann Parsons says this performance is part of an ongoing partnership.
This is a way of starting the partnership, starting to talk and work together.
Western classical music continues to have great popularity in China, and China is a popular destination for U.S. orchestras during tough economic times. The Philadelphia Orchestra has toured in China 3 times in the last decade, and in March became the first U.S. orchestra to video stream a performance from Shanghai. This trend seems likely to continue. This past April, the University of Wyoming Symphony closed out its spring concert series with one of China's best-loved pieces, the Butterfly Lover's Concerto, performed by a Chinese violinist, Sha. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Golden.
Coming up next in our show, a look at how a Laramie program is bringing art to people with disabilities, and a video game set in the cowboy state. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Aaron Schrank.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Picture this. You're a park ranger living in a watchtower in the Wyoming wilderness. No cell phone, no internet, no coworker to keep you company. Your only human contact is with your boss on a handheld radio. But when unexpected events occur, you're faced with exploring a wild and unknown environment. And that's where a new video game set in Wyoming begins. Wyoming Public Radio's Anna Rader has more.
This is the plot of Firewatch, the first video game to be released by a small game developer in San Francisco called Campo Santo. The game is the creation of two former Wyoming residents, designer and programmer Nels Anderson and designer and writer Sean Vanneman. Their past work includes big-name video games like The Walking Dead and Mark of the Ninja. Firewatch is set in the vast Shoshone National Forest in 1989, a year after the devastating Yellowstone fires. Nels Anderson was born and raised in Jackson and remembers the fires.
I was pretty young, but I still vaguely remember what that summer was like. Town was constantly smoky. That was a thing that always growing up in summer, it gets really smoky for a few days and people worry about their house getting burned down. That's normal, right? And actually, that's not an experience that most human beings have to live through.
Sean Vanneman moved to Cody when he was 9 and lived there until he went to college in 2002. He says living in Wyoming inspired Firewatch.
I like to be alone a lot, and Wyoming's a really good place for that because you can just go 5 minutes from your house or sometimes right outside your front door, depending on where you live, and be like really by yourself. And that's the feeling that I think has been sort of internalized in a lot of my work, maybe. I mean, it's something I feel I always bring to it. I'm always pulling from it.
Firewatch is what's called a first-person exploratory adventure game with a focus on plot and dialogue. What sets Firewatch apart from many video games is that there are no aliens, zombies, or monsters. Vanneman says it strives to be about real people from a real place.
The game is basically about the relationship between two people set like in the Wyoming backcountry. The game is not about challenge or defeating enemies. It's about learning to be the person that you are and forced to make dialogue decisions in conversation with somebody you're getting to know. But at the same time, you'll be uncovering a mystery.
The mystery unfolds as the protagonist maintains radio contact with his supervisor. Based on those conversations and decisions, the player dictates the direction of the game's plot. As with any good mystery set in the wilderness, the notion of isolation is fundamental to what Firewatch is about.
If you go out into the middle of nowhere with emotional baggage, how long is it until that stuff catches up with you? What does it take for that stuff to really start to like eat away at you in a way that's not healthy?
And Vanneman and Anderson want the game to feel as tangible as possible. From the books sitting in the Lookout's bookshelf to the foliage and geology, the game will transport players to smack dab in the middle of Wyoming.
We'll be using real city names. People are from real places in Wyoming at a real time and talk about how there's a rodeo every night in the summer in Cody. What it's like when there's traffic between Jackson and the Teton. Road construction, I should say. Hopefully we make good on
the Wyomingness.
On all the Wyomingness. That way we can go back to our respective towns and not be
ashamed.
Firewatch is set to be released in mid-2015 and will be available on PC, Mac, and Linux. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Anna Rader.
So hang your rose and your tennis coat. It's Campo Santo for me. Set sail for Campo Santo, boys.
1, 2, 3, 4.
This is the life for me.
The Cooper Center for the Creative Arts is a school for students with mental disabilities in Laramie. It's an extension of ARC Regional Services. The Cooper Center teaches classes like dance, painting, and theater. It allows students to reach beyond their disabilities through art. Wyoming Public Radio's Cordelia Zars has the story.
All right, so let's do hands on our bell buckles.
Dance class begins at 9 a.m. in the studio.
Loosen those hips up a little bit.
The 6 students disappear and are replaced by dancing cowboys, swaying and lassoing to the beat of the song. Instructor Casey DeMiranville leads. She helps them coordinate their bodies to the rhythm. The students are lost in the music, spinning, kicking, waving their arms.
Good, now walk. Okay. Good.
How does that feel, Eric?
Yeah, it's good.
All right, thanks, guys.
How does your body feel now?
Little bit of good.
A little bit of good.
Yeah.
Eric Peterson is a student at the Cooper Center, and he loves to dance. DeMiranville says often when students begin, they are shy and withdrawn. She says something about the arts changes how they see themselves.
Students seem to just come out of their shell and open up to people, and it is such an incredible boost of self-esteem.
That confidence is important for learning. Students with a wide range of cognitive disabilities begin taking classes in dance, theater, and art.
And I see them start to read better, start to communicate better.
DeMiranville says students are able to transfer those skills to life outside. Many now hold jobs and their own apartments.
Yeah, people learn art techniques and acting skills and things like that
Wendy Hoover is the education coordinator.
But they also learn other skills that apply elsewhere in their life.
Hoover says she watches students learn how to interact better, to be on time, to take care of instruments and tools. She says through art, students learn the skills and develop the confidence to
help them gain access to other opportunities in their lives.
Down the hall from the dance studio, a drumming class is in full swing. The students huddle in a tight circle, clasping the drums with their legs. They look at each other and down at their instruments. Their expressions vary between intense concentration and bliss. The group sound meets somewhere in between. They look completely content with the chaos. Because, as 22-year-old Kira Roberts explains, it's not about perfection. It's about trying.
I learned that I can do a lot more than just what I'm used to doing. Like, I found this one phrase that I made up. Keep going and keep trying.
Roberts has been at the Cooper Center for a little over a year, and she says the arts have changed her life. Her favorite class is theater.
Because I can actually get to do acting.
She touches her hand to her chest.
And actually get to be me.
Kira Roberts' classmate, Eleanor Verley, feels the same.
When I'm acting, I just feel confident.
Verley has acted since she was in high school. She's been in every Cooper Center production since the program began in 1999. The center puts on two shows every year in its theater. Wendy Hoover, the education coordinator, says this kind of program is rare.
I think that the fact that we have the Black Box Theater and we put on public performances and that we have artists who are working artists selling their work, that is unique to Wyoming.
Along with acting, student Eleanor Verley also paints. There's an art gallery in the lobby of the Cooper Center with students' work for sale. When Verley sells a painting, she feels
proud. It just makes me so proud of myself.
She's sold some of her acrylic work and has three more paintings up for sale now.
And is this a waterfall?
Yes.
I love that it's purple.
Yeah.
How did you decide to make a purple waterfall?
Instead of having just blue, we're not purple.
Why not purple? It's this freedom of imagination that has the power to transform these students' lives. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cordelia Zars.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again, listen to individual pieces or previous episodes, go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces.
You can also submit ideas for future programs on the website and comment on our stories. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can follow all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.